This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Der Handel an den Weltfinanzmärkten ist nicht einfach. Doch nur weil der Handel etwas schwierig sein kann, heißt das nicht, dass Ihr Broker es auch sein muss. Bei Kapital.com möchten wir Ihnen den Handel so einfach wie möglich machen. Ganz gleich, ob Sie ein Konto eröffnen oder eine Position auf unserer übersichtlichen, benutzerfreundlichen Plattform eröffnen möchten. Schauen Sie noch heute bei Kapital.com vorbei und finden Sie heraus, wie wir Ihnen helfen können, intelligenter zu handeln. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. So, finally, after nearly 15 months of war, there is a ceasefire and hostage release agreement for Gaza. Or at least that's what we're told last night by the mediators Qatar. Barring last-minute obstacles, and there are some, the deal is meant to come into force on Sunday. An end to the fighting to allow a gradual release of the remaining Israeli hostages, the release of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, a much greater influx of humanitarian aid into Gaza, and later the withdrawal of Israeli forces. Well, shortly after the announcement, Palestinian children in Gaza took to the streets to celebrate. And these people in Gaza City expressed, well, a range of emotions following the announcement of the deal.
My feeling about the ceasefire announcement is indescribable. Thank God that it was completed after the suffering we witnessed. The suffering, honestly, is just indescribable. Displacement, hunger, extermination. We were displaced from our houses under strikes, under fire, under the rubble.
We hope that the remaining hours before the truce comes into effect, that we don't lose loved ones during these hours, we don't lose someone dear to us again, and we won't be harmed by this crazy war. While I'm talking to you, you can hear the fire from all sides.
Well, Eitan Iron, a former resident of a kibbutz close to the Gaza border, told the BBC that despite the announcement of the deal, many uncertainties remained.
I'm happy about it, that it's going to take place at last. I hope that after a short while it will turn into a full deal, so although 98 hostages will be back and not just a third of them as it's coming now. And with the joy about that going to take place, there are still worries because we don't know who will come back alive, who will come just for burial, and those who will come alive, what condition there will be. So there is a lot of anxiety.
Well, as I mentioned, there are already bumps in the road. The Israeli cabinet was meant to meet earlier today to approve the deal. That's been delayed, with both sides accusing each other of trying to extract last-minute concessions. Let's speak to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who's in Jerusalem. And welcome, Jeremy. What seems to be the hold-up?
Well, the Israelis are basically saying that Hamas is trying a sly last-minute movement of the goalposts. Hamas is saying that's nonsense. I think they have tried to talk about some of the names of people they want released in return for hostages. But, you know, I think that a lot of this relates to the fact that Netanyahu is in the middle of a coalition crisis. There are, you know, those significant, small but significant and rather and highly extremist ultranationalist parties on, you know, which he needs for governmental support to keep his majority in the Israeli parliament, are very unhappy about what's happened, and they are themselves debating about whether or not they should try to bring down his government. So I think he's trying to signal to them that he's not going to stand for any nonsense, while at the same time I don't think it's credible that he's going to, after the incoming president, Donald Trump, in the US has said that this is an epic success, or words to that effect. I don't think he's going to push back against that.
And can those far-right parties actually bring down the government?
They can't stop a vote for the political agreement, for the ceasefire agreement. But while he has a pretty decent majority in the Knesset by Israeli standards, just a handful of votes, if there was a vote of confidence against him, and if the opposition decided that they would ally, that yeah, there would be enough votes if these ultranationalists took away their support to bring him down.
And why has there been continued Israeli bombardment of Gaza? Is that part of the politics, do you think?
Well, it might be, you know, as the German strategist in the 19th century, Clausewitz, said that war is an extension of politics by other means. I think that the Israelis would say that, of course, as ever, they are pushing back against any attempts by Hamas to regain any of the power that they had and to attack their people. No, I think the Israelis are trying again to send a message that they could go back on the warpath if necessary. And actually, because the agreement, which is in three parts, has the first stage, 42 days, I think there's possibly a reasonably even chance that they'll get to the 42 days. But to get to the next stage, which effectively ends the war, gets the rest of the hostages out, Palestinian prisoners, more Palestinian prisoners released, Israeli troops out of Gaza. I mean, especially that last bit is very controversial for the Israeli right. And will they get to stage two? I mean, that is one of the big questions.
What's your sense of why the deal has been done now, assuming it does come into force? Is it the Trump factor, as you hinted at a little earlier?
Yeah, I think it is, because Biden put this deal on the table, and it has changed a bit, but not massively. Back last May, by midsummer, Hamas had effectively accepted it. Yeah, there were some points that had to be negotiated, but with a will on both sides, it could have been done. I think there was it was pretty clear that was certainly the American belief, and sources in Qatar told me something very similar. But Netanyahu brought in various other stipulations and conditions, and one of these ultranationalist ministers, who at the moment is causing him a lot of trouble, Itamar Ben-Gvir, he has said publicly that in the last months he himself has headed off this agreement by raising objections to it and putting Netanyahu under pressure. So I think it is very clear that Israeli politics have and the politics of Netanyahu's coalition have pushed him towards trying to prolong the war and putting off making that deal, the ceasefire deal. And he's a man who is very comfortable. He feels he has the measure of Joe Biden, and he can push back against him as much as he can. He's not as comfortable with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not the kind of person who likes being told what to do, or indeed having his will defied.
Jeremy, thank you very much indeed. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, joining us live there from Jerusalem. Well, let's get some reaction to the deal as it stands at the moment from one of the many people in Israel desperately waiting for news of their loved ones, still being held by Hamas in Gaza. 94 men, women and children, of whom 34 are thought to have died. Adam Manit's cousin, Tsaki Idan, was taken by Hamas after his 18-year-old daughter was murdered by the group on October the 7th, 2023. Adam's on the line now, and thank you very much for being with us here on NewsHour. What are your thoughts and, indeed, emotions about the deal right now?
Good afternoon. It's a very tumultuous time at the moment. There's been a lot of echoes of previous deals that were supposedly imminent. We've been here before, and we felt that sense of stratospheric optimism quickly quashed on the rocks of despair. So I've learned, and we've all learned, to be guarded in our optimism. We do have to be sanguine about the prospect, but we do have to also be cautious and not be overly invested emotionally in this particular deal, because we've been here before. We've seen it collapse. We've seen these games being played, last minute conditions, various concessions trying to be extracted from various parties. So I think this is also part of the psychological warfare that Hamas enjoys inflicting on us, with our loved ones as the pawns in their grand game where they feel like they can dangle their lives and their potential freedom so close to us and then snatch it away.
What about the arguments that clearly seem to be going on within the Israeli cabinet and the governing coalition? What about that? How does that make you feel?
I am not a politician. I'm not a diplomat. And I'm certainly not a military expert. I do know that the vast majority of Israelis support the deal that is currently being, if the details are correct, that's currently on offer. I know that even a large percentage of the Likud party members themselves support it. The vast majority of Israeli society wants to see their people brought home.
I mean, are far-right members of the cabinet playing politics with the lives of the hostages and indeed people in Gaza? We've had more than 70 Palestinians killed just today.
I think Hamas also plays politics. I think Qatar plays politics. I think Iran plays politics. I think all parties involved in the Middle East are playing a game of sorts. I don't think there's anything particularly unusual about various political factions trying to leverage concessions using whatever leverage they have. I think the real problem here is that we've allowed this to happen as the international community, as the UK government, as the UN, as all the parties involved have allowed Hamas to have this much power. If on October 7th we had said, as the international community, as the world, stood united, steadfast and defiant against Hamas's terrorism and extremism, against the terrorism and extremism of Islamic Jihad that have brought ruin upon not just Israeli lives, but on the Palestinian lives as well, and demanded that the states that support them, like Iran and Qatar and Egypt, have all manner of pressure put upon them by our Western governments, by the United Nations, by the international community, to demand that they do whatever they can to pressure Hamas to surrender and to unconditionally release the hostages, rather than to try to eke out a deal. We would have potentially not only freed all of the hostages, but we would have potentially also prevented the havoc and devastation that has been wrought in the Middle East.
Adam, we've got just 30 seconds or so left. Can I just ask you this? I mean, have you had any official information on when Tsaki might be released as part of the agreement?
We've had no official information. We don't even have proof of life. He's not been visited by the Red Cross. He's not been visited by a British diplomat or a UN diplomat. We've had no word from the Israeli government. We've had no word from the Qatari government. So we are just as in the dark as everyone else.
Thank you very much indeed for your time today. Adam Manit, whose cousin Tsaki Adam was taken by Hamas on October the 7th, 2023. More reaction. We will be speaking to a member of Israel's governing coalition in just a couple of minutes' time. And as ever, there is a live page up and running with all the details of the agreement and more reaction from the region. BBCnews.com. Also coming up, Hamas says that the number of dead in Gaza is more than 45,000. But we'll hear from a medical researcher who says that the real number is likely to be much higher. And he'll tell us why. There are many reasons that the official numbers are an underestimate.
You have a system in Gaza that relied on an electronic data collection system at hospital level. Now, that has failed in a number of hospitals. You also have insecurity that prevents families from actually taking their loved ones to hospitals when they pass away. You also have entire households that disappear in one go when, for example, the building is hit, and therefore there is no one left to report the death.
That's coming up in 20 minutes. Let's just recap our main news this hour. Israel is delaying a cabinet vote on the Gaza ceasefire deal after accusing Hamas of reneging on elements of the agreement. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Well, let's talk now to Ohad Tal, who's chair of the far-right religious Zionist faction in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. The party's leader, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, sits in the Israeli cabinet. Ohad Tal joins me now live. Thank you very much for being with us here on NewsHour. Prime Minister Netanyahu has blamed Hamas for the delay to the cabinet meeting. I just wonder, though, is it in fact your party and the Jewish Power Party of Itamar Ben-Gvir that are the obstacles right now?
First of all, of course, we are against the deal. We do not think that that is a good deal. I think every deal that keeps Hamas in power and doesn't bring all the hostages back is a bad deal. I mean, we all understand that Hamas suffered a severe hit in the last year, but now to allow them to get their oxygen back, now to allow them to gain their control back and to stay in power, to allow basically also to hundreds of thousands of people of Gaza to go back to their homes, and the money will come back and flood Gaza, and everything will be rebuilt again, and they will be able to rearm themselves without taking Hamas away from the control of Gaza. That is a huge mistake.
And yet, Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, said on Tuesday that Israel had pursued its military campaign past the point of destroying Hamas's military capacity. They can't really do anything now, can they?
As long as Hamas is still in power, I mean, again, they've suffered a serious hit. But if we are keeping them in power, if they're in control, if they're running Gaza, then what have we done? We're basically folding back all the achievements of the war by signing this deal. So, of course, we are against the deal. But now the fact that it's being delayed, it's not because of what we are, because of our stand against the deal, but mostly because Hamas is now trying to create, to go back from the agreements and to try and get more, even more, to achieve even more than what was already agreed. And this is what I understand is holding now the deal back.
Are you going to leave the governing coalition over this deal?
It's a good question. It's a good question. I can tell you that honestly, we are discussing it among ourselves. And I think the only way, I mean, we will, of course, vote against the deal. But the question is, if we're leaving the government, will be decided only according to if we will get insurances that after the first stage of the deal will complete, Israel will go back to fight Gaza, will go back to fight Hamas, and will make sure that we are removing them from power. If we will not get these insurances, then of course we will not be able to stay in this government.
So just to be clear, you'll only support the deal if it doesn't last, if Israel can go back to fighting Hamas somewhere down the line.
You know, we've promised the people of Israel, and you know, not just the people of Israel, we've promised the world that we will eradicate Hamas. I think that serves the best interest of everybody. It serves the interest of the Egyptians and of the Emiratis and the Saudis and the Jordanians and the peace and stability of the world. This is what it serves. And if we cannot deliver that, what's the purpose of being in the government? We promise a very simple thing, to bring back the hostages and to eradicate Hamas. If that's not happening, we will not be able to keep being in the government. It's very simple.
Just one final question. I mean, this week, Itamar Ben-Gvir of Jewish Power boasted that he'd repeatedly blocked previous attempts to reach a deal. Can your party say the same? Is that what your party has been doing over the past 9 months?
You know, it's very funny to discuss Israeli politics on a BBC, but of course this is an absurd. It's very very strange to claim that while all international representatives, including Blinken and everybody, stated time and time again that the only one who stopped the deals until today was Hamas refusing to move ahead. So it's quite strange to claim for an Israeli politician that he was blocking the deal.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Ohad Tal of the religious Zionist faction in the Israeli parliament, also sits on the Foreign Affairs Committee. Well, Rami Morjan is chemistry professor at the Islamic University of Gaza. He had to leave his home in Gaza City because of the fighting. He's now living in Deir el-Bala in the centre of the Strip. What does he feel about the announcement of a ceasefire agreement?
Actually, we all have celebrated last night when we heard that a ceasefire agreement has been announced. And most of people were very excited to hear that we are so close to the end of the blood shower. And in fact, we are waiting and counting minutes or even seconds to get to work, because in fact, the war is still on and Israel is still attacking people.
There seems to be some delay with the vote by the Israeli cabinet. They need to approve this deal. There seems to be some last-minute problems. Are you worried that it may not last, this deal?
Absolutely, we are worried, because we have a long history of Israeli Zionist government that they are always find justification to escape from any agreement. So we are worried that the Israeli wing government will destroy this agreement.
They say, Rami, that it's Hamas that's putting forward last-minute conditions on the deal. I mean, is it possible that both sides are creating problems?
I believe that Hamas has reached the point that they don't add any extra notes on the agreement. So to the best of my knowledge, and as I've reading the news, Hamas has agreed with no comments.
Do you have a home to go back to if the ceasefire does hold and comes into force on Sunday? I mean, what will the first thing that you do be when the bombs, and if the bombs stop falling?
My home in Gaza City is still stand. Yeah, there's a need for a lot of rehabilitation, but it's still stand, and I will live in even it's just one room there. Even if my house has been destroyed, I will live in a tenant. But definitely, I'm looking forward to go back to Gaza City, the place I love, to start my life again.
Because what are conditions like where you are at the moment? I think you're in Deir el-Bala, aren't you?
I am in Deir el-Balah, living with my brother-in-law. But in general, the circumstances in both sides, Gaza and Deir el-Balah, will be hard after Israel has destroyed everything. But as we're still alive, we can rebuild our houses, our universities, our schools. It's a big job, but we are willing to do and reconstruct Gaza Strip.
Also, I mean, every territory, every people needs some sort of administration, some sort of government. Who should that be? Who should run Gaza in the months to come, do you think?
It's going to be like a transition state. Actually, I lived in UK and I learned a lot about the principle of democracy. Who has the right to decide who's going to govern the Palestinian people is just the Palestinian. And this can be determined through democratic elections. It's not easy to make an election after the war, but we need like a transition state. And the Palestinian Authority should take the rule. The international community must put pressure on Israel to allow the Palestinian Authority to control Gaza. This is the basic principle of democracy.
That was Rami Morjan, who's a chemistry professor in the Gaza Strip. More on this story coming up in the second half of the programme. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service.
Der Handel an den Weltfinanzmärkten ist nicht einfach. Doch nur weil der Handel etwas schwierig sein kann, heißt das nicht, dass Ihr Broker es auch sein muss. Bei Capital.com möchten wir Ihnen den Handel so einfach wie möglich machen. Ganz gleich, ob Sie ein Konto eröffnen oder eine Position auf unserer übersichtlichen, benutzerfreundlichen Plattform eröffnen möchten. Schauen Sie noch heute bei Capital.com vorbei und finden Sie heraus, wie wir Ihnen helfen können, intelligenter zu handeln. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Welcome back to NewsHour. We're going to step away from the Middle East for a few minutes to talk about something President Biden said in his farewell address at the White House last night, and it's this bit.
Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence. that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead. We see the consequences all across America, and we've seen it before, more than a century ago.
Let's talk to Christopher Witko, Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Penn State University and co-author of the book Hijacking the Agenda, Economic Power and Political Influence. Welcome to NewsHour. First of all, what is an oligarchy?
Well, an oligarchy just means rule by the few, but I think nowadays we typically mean rule by the wealthy few.
And does America now fit the definition? Is President Biden right?
Well, the business and the wealthy certainly have a lot of power right now in the U.S. compared to, say, 60, 70 years ago when you had a stronger union movement and things of that nature. So and political scientists have made the argument that we are kind of in an oligarchy. So he's not too far off base, I don't think.
And he referred to the fact that, you know, he said we'd seen it in America more than a century ago. What happened then? Is that the sort of Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts?
Yeah, exactly. So that's called the Gilded Age here in the U.S. And some people have said we're in a second Gilded Age now because we have big tech companies accumulating massive amounts of wealth, just like the robber barons, the Carnegies and so forth, did back in the late 1800s.
Gilded Age implies also that, you know, there is economic growth, and that's certainly true now. Are there benefits to an oligarchy?
There, I guess you could say there are some benefits, but most of those benefits, unfortunately, go to the people at the very top of the income distribution, which is exactly what we're seeing here in the U.S.
So how do you curb it?
Well, the first Gilded Age excesses were curbed by things like the estate tax and breaking up trusts and things of that nature. And there's proposals to do similar things now, like a wealth tax, for instance, has been proposed by a number of members of Congress. There's currently an antitrust case against Amazon.com. So similar things are taking place.
And what are the dangers to America's political institutions, to its democracy? Does it have an impact on that?
Oh, without question. I think we saw Elon Musk this election spending massive amounts of money to turn out the vote. And then, of course, he owns a large social media platform as well. And I think the fact that there is this kind of presence on social media and ownership of, you know, an important means of communication is really important too.
Christopher Witko, thank you very much indeed. Chris is Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Penn State University. You're listening to NewsHour. This is the BBC World Service in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Well, let's return to our top story and the ceasefire and hostage release agreement between Israel and Hamas, announced last night but still waiting for ratification by the Israeli cabinet. It is due to come into force on Sunday. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, has been gauging reaction to the deal in Israel and in Gaza, although I should underline that the BBC has not been allowed to report from inside Gaza since the war began.
There was celebration and relief in Gaza last night as news of the deal came through. Survival, a victory in itself for this woman.
We are very happy about the agreement. It gives us hope for Gaza's future. The agreement guarantees that no more lives will be lost. After experiencing genocide, this agreement means saving lives. The end of the war brings us an indescribable joy.
But this morning, the reality that the killing hasn't stopped yet. At the Baptist Hospital in Gaza, they were bringing in the dead and the injured. At least 80 people, including 19 children, have been killed in Israeli strikes since the agreement was announced, according to officials in Gaza. Still, amid the destruction, hope that the worst might be over. Enough is enough, says 14-year-old Ahmed. It's better for us to go back to our homes and sit on the rubble than deal with death every day. But not everyone is happy with the agreement. In Jerusalem today, there were protests from Israelis who say the war shouldn't stop until Hamas is wiped out. This deal is expected to be approved by the Israeli government this afternoon, but it's divisive. These people, many of them the family members of fallen Israeli soldiers, want Prime Minister Netanyahu to pull out.
Don't vote for that deal. That deal, it's a very dangerous deal. That deal gonna leave behind us in Gaza Strip about 70 hostages.
But as they marched in protest, others were watching, who say now is the time to start bringing the hostages home. Ronnie Moretz has been on a partial hunger strike for 120 days to pressure the government to do a deal.
Every war ever were ending by an agreement. You cannot destroy the enemy. You cannot kill the last soldier. You need to stop and make an agreement. And I agree that this is a deal with the devil, but I don't think that we have any other option.
And despite the protests, given the way the world has welcomed news of the agreement, it will be difficult for Prime Minister Netanyahu to back out now.
John Donaldson reporting there. Well, let's hear now from Hamas. Bassem Naim is head of political and international relations for the group. He's based in Turkey. I asked him whether Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, whether his claim that Hamas had reneged on certain parts of the deal, and that was what was holding up, was accurate.
Absolutely not. We are fully committed to the deal. And by the way, this is the deal of May 27, 2024, which we have accepted and agreed upon. And at that time, it was rejected by Netanyahu and his government. We are fully committed to the agreement, but we believe that Netanyahu, because he is failing to bring consensus behind this agreement in his government, he is trying to sabotage the positive atmosphere by creating such claims.
Our Gaza correspondent tells us, though, that Hamas is trying to get some last-minute concessions, particularly on which prisoners are released from Israeli jails. He says that you want at least one or two high-profile prisoners to be included in the list. Can you tell us any more about that?
No. It is not true. And by the way, most of the names and the list are already solved, because it is clear in the agreement which names and which categories are going to be released in the first phase of this agreement. We are talking about elderly, sick people, women from both sides to be exchanged. Therefore, there is no space for any manipulations or any games.
If the deal does hold and leads to a lasting ceasefire and perhaps, in the weeks and months to come, a lasting peace, I just wonder what you think all this has achieved. I mean, your actions on October the 7th have led to the deaths of, well, at least 46,000 of your fellow Palestinians. 90% of people in Gaza have had to leave their homes. 60% of buildings in the territory have been damaged. What was it all for?
I think our first priority today is to see how to implement this ceasefire agreement, how to succeed to stop the aggression and to undermine any attempt by Netanyahu to have a new chance to relaunch the aggression or the war against our people. The second priority is, yes, to set together all the Palestinians from all factions, from all social groups, and to reevaluate what happened along the 15 months.
And just thinking about all those different Palestinian factions, the international community wants Gaza to be governed by someone other than Hamas, some sort of unified Palestinian leadership. Will you accept that?
Look, you can say what you want. You can adopt the Israeli narrative as you want, believe. But at the end, this is only propaganda. And you are not depending on facts when you say this. Hamas has said it many times. We are ready to go for free, transparent election and leave the people on the ground to decide about their leadership, about their future, about their way to get rid of the occupation. And Hamas is ready to accept and to respect. If you are a journalists who are living in the West, you have to respect, I think, this choice.
Right. It's hard to imagine elections taking place, but if people were to reject Hamas, you'd accept that, would you?
You cannot impose your beliefs or the propaganda of Netanyahu and the Israeli government on the Palestinian people based on fake information or propaganda. Again, we are part of the Palestinian people. We are representing a vast majority of the Palestinian people, and we are ready to go for free and transparent election and to give the people the choice to choose their leadership and to choose their way how to get rid of the occupation.
That was Bassem Naim, Hamas's head of political and international relations. Well, we've talked today and often in the past about the human cost of this war. The 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, who were killed on October the 7th, and the 46,000 Palestinians who've been killed in the war that followed. That figure comes from the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza, regarded as reliable by the UN. It doesn't distinguish between combatants and civilians, although Israel has claimed it's killed 17,000 Hamas fighters in the past 15 months. And a recent analysis by the UN Human Rights Office suggests almost 70% of those killed in Gaza are women and children. But new research published last week in the medical journal The Lancet suggests that the figure of 46,000 may be a significant underestimate. It says that in the 9 months to the end of June 2024, 64,000 Palestinians died from what it calls traumatic injury. Francesco Checchi is Professor of Epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and leader of the team that carried out the study.
We know from doing this kind of research in other armed conflict settings that the true number of people killed in these conflicts tends to be underestimated. So what we did in Gaza is we actually took three separate lists that were publicly available. The first is a list of deaths from mortuaries across Gaza. The second is an online survey that the Ministry of Health in Gaza circulated last year. And the third is actually one that we composed ourselves from publicly available social media obituary pages. And basically, we looked at the overlap among those three lists and used a well-established statistical technique that estimates the number of people not detected by any of the lists, i.e. it basically sums up what we know and what we cannot see, what is unknown, and comes up with a total.
So you found that there wasn't that much overlap. Is that the point between the lists?
Correct. There wasn't that much overlap among the lists, and the statistical model therefore estimates that there's a sizable number of people who are outside of any list. And so the total then becomes that unseen number outside of the lists plus the number that do appear on any one of the lists we analyzed.
Why are they not counting some people?
I think there is a number of reasons that comes into play. You first of all have a system in Gaza that relied before the war on an electronic data collection system at hospital level. Now, that has failed in a number of hospitals, such that people being taken to mortuaries are not, in fact, entered onto records. You also have insecurity that prevents families from actually taking their loved ones to hospitals when they pass away. You also have entire households that disappear in one go when, for example, the building is hit, and therefore there is no one left to actually report the death. So it's really, I think, the summation of all of those different reasons that explains why all of the available systems aren't, in fact, picking up the true number.
And how reliable a method is this?
Well, it has some limitations, but it has been used in a number of armed conflict settings previously, Sudan, Yemen, Kosovo, Colombia, and it's fairly well established. We, of course, went through a pretty extensive peer review process. And yeah, I think we would say that it's a reasonably well established method.
And do you know what proportion of the numbers that you uncovered are women, children, and the elderly? Were you able to ascertain that?
Yes, just about 59%. So these would be groups that we would consider unlikely to be combatants.
And how were you able to ascertain the cause of death? Because these were deaths by traumatic injury. How were you able to make sure that that was the cause of death? In other words, from the conflict?
So wherever possible, we excluded from the data sets anyone who may have died of a cause that was not stated to be traumatic injury. The social media source that we used had a lot of very extensive details, including pictures. The online survey that the Ministry of Health circulated made specific reference to people killed traumatically. So we did what we could to really exclude any other cause of death. But that also in turn means that our estimate does not, in fact, account for all of the indirect effects of the war on health, people dying of chronic diseases that go without treatment, of malnutrition, and so on and so forth.
Israel, of course, says that any information out of Gaza is unreliable. And obviously, you're doing this from outside with raw data sets. I mean, is there a fundamental problem with those data sets, do you think?
Both we and other academic groups have looked at the data that the Ministry of Health puts out. These are quite detailed lists. They contain names, last names, ages, national ID numbers. We have looked at that in many different ways to see whether we could actually spot any sign of people faking the data. And the conclusion is that there does not seem to be any fabrication. So we consider those sources reliable. The true number is almost certainly above 70,000 by now and probably closer to 80,000.
Professor Francesco Checchi of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine there. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Back to our top story. The health ministry in Gaza says that dozens of Palestinians, more than 70, have been killed by Israeli strikes ahead of a ceasefire deal coming into force between Israel and Hamas. Meanwhile, long lines of aid trucks are parked up outside the southern crossing into Gaza. As part of the deal, there's meant to be a surge in aid deliveries to Gaza with some 600 trucks allowed in each day. Let's talk to James Elder, who speaks for the UN's Children's Agency, UNICEF, who joins us live from Geneva. James, thanks very much for being with us. If this does come into force on Sunday, are there trucks ready and waiting to go into Gaza? Are you poised?
Yeah, very much so, James, for a long, long time. We've got to remember beyond, as you just, listeners have been hearing, the horrendous nature of just how many children are killed every single day. Children are being killed from malnutrition. Children are dying through hypothermia. The last 3 months of 2024, we saw the lowest number of trucks allowed in to access these people in the entirety of this horror show. So yes, very, very ready. But there are a whole lot of challenges to face in Gaza, most of all, the simple fact that you've got an entire population absolutely on their knees. They've been displaced multiple times, James. 95% of people are food insecure. Medicines are at a critical level. So we cannot understate just how much needs to be done. So why we need peace to be given a chance, not a few weeks of a ceasefire, but many, many months leading into a permanent one.
And what about that question of with so much damage in Gaza? I mean, where are people going to live in the weeks and months to come, assuming the ceasefire does stick?
You know, James, I think sometimes it's worthwhile just tapping into what people tell me. And before this, I was speaking to someone I'd met on the ground in Gaza who's in Deri Bala, who is one of those people. She's a medical student. She's been displaced.
Oh.
The north is destroyed. Her exact words were to me, look, you know, we're thankful the killing can stop, but we're in a tent. If we choose to go home, we will still be in a tent. But we have hope. We love life and we just want a chance now to live it. So the reality is when you've got 2/3 of homes and buildings, 95% of schools damaged or destroyed, we haven't really seen a reconstruction of the scale needed like this. And that's physical reconstruction. We are looking at uncharted territory in terms of the trauma of children. So a huge amount of work to be done, James, but it only starts with real sincerity from both sides here, a proper ceasefire that goes on and on and on for a long, long suffering people.
Thank you very much, James Elder of UNICEF, speaking to us from Geneva. Well, let's take a slightly longer view of the agreement and where it might lead if it does indeed hold. Let's speak to Daniel Levy, a former Israeli peace negotiator. Thank you very much for being with us today on NewsHour. Just picking up from what James Elder was saying, I mean, first of all, what are the chances of this ceasefire sticking? I mean, it hasn't even started yet, has it?
Indeed, James. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu did not want to get to this moment, and he is still not accepting that he has to be in this moment. We have been told by especially Secretary Blinken, but many in the Biden administration, that the obstacle was Hamas. You know, in a really delicate diplomatic process to get to a deal, sometimes you have to massage the truth. You need to give the side that's more reluctant a victory narrative. Blinken did much more than that. He's consistently lied to us in ways that have undermined things. But here we are now, and there's almost a consensus from all sides, which is very unusual in Israel, from the pro-Netanyahu political class and media and the anti-Netanyahu, that he didn't want the deal, that he held it up. Some thought that was the right thing, some didn't. That under pressure from Trump, under pressure from the fact that Trump is an American president who acts like the leader of a superpower vis-a-vis Israel, he felt he had to move. But he knew all along that if there was a deal, he would have domestic political instability, and that's exactly where we are. So what is going on? I think Netanyahu is trying two things. Number one, he's trying to buy a bit of time to see if he can calm down that domestic opposition. Perhaps he's even been waiting for the start of the day in Washington to have some of the Trump world speak to some of these recalcitrant ministers. I can't guarantee that.
Would that mean offering them some concessions? I mean, we spoke to one far-right member of his coalition who suggested, you know, they'd go along with the ceasefire for a bit as long as Israel could step in against Hamas again a few weeks down the line.
Look, the intention all along, people all along have said, look, if you can get to a first phase, you're not going to see it through to the end. Netanyahu, I think, if he has to do any deal, will try and trip it up, whether before it gets implemented or during its implementation. But, and this matters, he knows that once this gains momentum, it's difficult also domestically in Israel, because once they start seeing live Israeli hostages coming out, then for him to turn around and say, it's Hamas's fault and I stop now because I don't want to finish this. Your family, they're not getting out. That's difficult. Maybe media, including yourselves, will go in and show us what's been going on in Gaza much more than we've seen because Israel stopped the media going in. So there's a whole dynamic there which makes it difficult for him. I don't think those commitments have been given. I think there are other things to do with what Israel can do in the West Bank, to do with normalization. All these other things Netanyahu and his coalition allies would have expected to get anyway from a Trump administration. But here we are. Netanyahu doesn't want to see this through. Nonetheless, he is cornered for the time being. And I do think it would be difficult to maneuver back out of that. We're seeing mass killings in Gaza in the meantime. So we're going to see these provocations in the hope that he could make a claim that Hamas is torpedoing this stick. But that's the critical phase we're in right now. Unfortunately, you've pointed it out, James, if we get over this hump, it's going to be an extremely bumpy road ahead, unless Netanyahu, in particular, his feet are held to the fire consistently.
And Daniel, in just the minute we've got left, I mean, you sort of answered my question, which was going to be, does this open any sort of window to some sort of progress in the fundamental conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, or is that just firmly closed?
It's a crucial question to be asking, because if that isn't the case, then we can't get back to a place where Palestinians and Israelis will have security. October 6th was a normal day for Israelis, but it was just another day of occupation, apartheid, and living without freedom and rights for Palestinians. Until you address that, you won't get that mutual security. Unfortunately, James, even if we get somehow through most of this deal, we're talking about a ceasefire. We are not talking about addressing the fundamentals. There is really no center of political gravity in Israel today that is ready to do that unless Israel is held accountable. I don't think that will change.
Daniel, thank you very much indeed. Very good to talk to you. Daniel Levy, former Israeli peace negotiator there, bringing us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team, thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.